is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now, there is a commemorative marker at the site where a flood wall protecting the lower ninth wall collapsed, unleashing a wall of water 10 years ago during Hurricane Katrina. The resulting flood wiped out the African-American neighborhood and killed scores of its residents. And now what has been left in its wake is little more than the commemorative marker at the site where the flood wall protecting the neighborhood collapsed.
10 years after Hurricane Katrina made landfall in southeast Louisiana, journalist, author of Katrina After the Flood, Gary Rivlin, retraces the storm's damage, the city of New Orleans' efforts to rebuild itself, and the storm's lasting effects, not just on the city's geography and infrastructure, but on the psychic, racial, and social fabric of that city, highlighting the mass dislocation of the African-American residents of the Lower Ninth Ward and why the neighborhood still hasn't been thrown a life preserver.
And we'll continue to ask whether government's benign neglect of the impoverished African-American population has still not been answered for, and indeed whether it continues to sacrifice the poor on the altar of whiter and wealthier developers and development. Gary Rivlin, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I want to begin with actually a post by the Color of Change, which says, hey, 10 years ago, it was the Gulf Coast. Now it's Oakland and Sanford. It's Ferguson and Staten Island. It's Baltimore, Chicago, and Waller County, Texas. And it's still New Orleans. The fight to improve the lives of black folks is happening everywhere. What they are saying is that what happened during Katrina was a systemic failure of government from the White House down to the mayor's office. Can we start with that? Is that your assessment, that that is a primary lesson to take away as we watch the gleeful presence of George W. Bush at one of the charter schools on the 10th anniversary of Katrina?
Right. It's yes, it was a systematic failure, and maybe it's worse. Is we all, the whole world, saw the failures of the Bush administration to rescue folks who were stuck for 5 days. 25,000 people were stuck for 5 days at the Superdome. Another 20,000 at the convention center. They weren't rescued to day six or seven. This is a city right along a river. I mean, it shouldn't have been that hard if it had been more of a priority. But, you know, what's worse to me is in the rebuilding, the way race and class played this insidious role that helped shape a New Orleans that's very different today than it was at the time of Katrina.
I wonder if you could expand on that, not only in terms of it being a failure, but perhaps what has happened has been a proactive policy on the part of the ruling class to change the composition of the city.
So let's start with public housing. We'll start with, you know, low-income African-Americans. Some public housing was flooded, but much of it wasn't. But rather than opening it in those first months when the city was desperate for affordable housing, right? I mean, 80% of the city was covered with water, so housing was at a real premium. They never opened. Even those units that were not flooded, they're just all surrounded in fencing and razor wire on top and never opened. Year one, year two, people are desperate. People's stuff was inside, but they never let them inside. And in fact, the big four housing project units in New Orleans, all of them were knocked down, all of them were replaced by mixed income. New Orleans, the city with the oldest public hospital, Cherry Hospital, in the country, it and Bellevue date back to 1736 by coincidence. Moderate damage. FEMA said $100 million we could fix it up. The doctors, the nurses, the other staff there started working on it. But the state before Katrina had wanted to shut it down. And, you know, Naomi Klein, disaster capitalism, this was the moment. Shock doctrine, this was the moment that they could take advantage. New Orleans now has no public hospital. You know, Charity Hospital is just sitting there moldering. It has never opened. It will never open. You just go down the line. Renters, 54% of New Orleans for renters. There was a lot of concern for homeowners in New Orleans, but there was never a plan to help renters back to have affordable housing for people, because what happens when most of your city is flooded, rents soared. It went up like the first year, like 30-35% rents, and so it became this unaffordable place, especially for the working poor, those who, you know, work in the kitchen help, the housekeepers in the big hotels, trying to get by on $15,000-$20,000 a year, and suddenly rents are going up by 35%.
You know, Gary, the reason one of the other reasons I mentioned Bush is the system. The systems of government patted themselves somewhat on the back as they look at the bright, shiny new streets and pavement in the heart of New Orleans, which, of course, many of the long-term residents, African American, have described as kind of Disneyfied or poor caricature of the culture that exists theretofore. But we have Mr. Bush in a charter school, and virtually all of the schooling, if not all of it, is now charterized. And one of the things that hit me is that most of the jobs previously in the school system were African-American individuals who were certainly aspiring towards the middle class. Those jobs were completely wiped out, and now you have a privatized, deunionized workforce that is without benefits, without the other protections that unions had. And so it's a further destruction of the job base and quality of life in the true sense of the African American workforce. Is that something that, I mean, it was something that just kind of hit me. Is that something that you've seen as a reality of the loss of public sector jobs and so on?
Yeah, so we were talking about the working poor, lower income folks. Now let's step up the class ladder. So teachers, administrators, more middle class jobs. So the state, the moderate Democrat at the time, Kathleen Blanco, had been pushing prior to Katrina to take over some of the New Orleans public schools. Some of them were not doing well. I mean, understood what the motivation was there. But, you know, there's a duly elected school board. And so before the storm, there was an effort, and they took over three or four of the worst performing schools. But after the storm, within two months of Katrina, the state had taken over virtually every public school in New Orleans. St. Bernard Parish, it's a suburban parish just south and east of New Orleans. It was 100% flooded. They didn't lay off all their teachers. They put them on, you know, emergency leave. They didn't have the money to pay them, you know, full time. But as soon as they started rebuilding the schools, they were the first ones hired back. Orleans Parish, the New Orleans public school, they fired en masse every single teacher, every single employee, 7,000 or so people. And that's, by the way, on top of the 3,000 city workers who were laid off at around that time. So you had like 10,000 families, largely African-American, dealing with a loss of job at the same time they're losing homes and they're displaced. And there was a lawsuit that the teachers filed saying, like, okay, but once you start restarting the schools, we have tenure, we have rights of first refusal for a job. The lower courts ruled in favor of the teachers. The higher court, the appellate court, ruled in favor of the teachers. But there wasn't any money. I mean, it was like, oh, now you owe them $1.5 billion. Well, you know, the public school system in New Orleans didn't have it, you know, one-third, one-fifth that kind of money. So, you know, it's just this empty victory that they won. Then there's kind of this period. So right after the storm, 100 out of the 120 or so schools were flooded. Every school was closed in those first months, but slowly schools are coming around. It was so chaotic. I wrote a story recently about the Katrina kids, those who were in school at the time of Katrina, and saw at first the government didn't care. They're stuck in this flooded city. The federal government's not rescuing them. And then they're traumatized. They have to come back to these schools. They're changing constantly. You know, so let's start a charter school. Well, this charter school opens, but it closes 2 years later. Now you have to go find another one. People talked about what they needed after Katrina was just a sense of stability. We liked the neighborhood school. It wasn't perfect, but we knew the teachers. We had a relationship there. The older brother went there. A student was there for a few years, and then Katrina hit, but they're gone. You know, it's no longer a neighborhood system. You're right. It's a 90% plus charter system. You have all these stories of, like, some kid, he's in elementary school, getting up at 6 a.m. in the dark, waiting at a bus stop, you know, to transfer to get to school. It's really this chaotic system that in the last couple of years has finally stabilized. But you have special needs kids. There was a lawsuit, and the public school system had to admit they were failing the special needs kids, because what you saw the charter schools doing is cherry picking. You know, we want certain kinds of students because we want to show that our scores are going up. New Orleans actually the leading suspension rate in the country, and I have to think it's because it was a charter system that wanted to show off how well it was doing and got rid of any kid was expendable if they weren't helping with the numbers.
The mass layoffs of the teachers and paraprofessionals in the school systems, and some people say that the African-American middle class has been shrinking and poverty is increasing, especially a situation which is really desperate for people given the fact that living costs are so high.
Right. I mean, New Orleans is a much more expensive city today than it was prior to Katrina. Some of that is housing. Some of it is because the center of town is thriving. You have gentrified neighborhoods. A little bit feels like Brooklyn. There are a few neighbors, so prices, house prices, rents, you know, there's a lot of good that comes with that. You know, the art scene, the restaurant scene, you know, there's a real vibrancy there. But at the same time, it just becomes a more expensive city in what we see. And this statistic is just tragic. So New Orleans has the second highest wealth gap of all American cities. In case you're curious, Atlanta is number one. It's on par. The wealth gap in New Orleans is on par with Zambia in Africa. And the most tragic part is it's getting wider. In the year 2000, the median income for a black family was $30,000 a year in New Orleans. In 2013, that was down to $25,000 for the median black family. Go to white families, it was in the high 40s prior to Katrina. Now it's around 60. They're seeing a growth in the white community, and in the black community is a move backwards. It's because of an inequity among the recovery. I like to say it was not an equal opportunity storm. If you owned a home in New Orleans, you were more than three times more likely to be flooded out by Katrina and the failure of the levees if you're a black homeowner than if you're a white homeowner. And there's racial geography. The whites got to the high ground first. By the time black homeownership was widely available, folks had no choice but to move in the lower-lying areas. So much of the city that flooded, that was heavily the black community. And I mentioned before that all the attention was on homeowners, not renters. Even there was inequity. Let's move up the class ladder to middle class and professional class. They based this program called Road Home, $10 billion program, the largest housing recovery program in U.S. history, an amazing program. And, you know, from the federal government putting forward all this money, they decided to give the money out not based on the cost of rebuilding, not replacement cost to use the insurance term, but based on the assessed value of the home prior to Katrina. And, you know, basically you go neighborhood by neighborhood and you see that the same 2,000 square foot home in a white community is worth twice as much money as one in the black community. So you've got a program that's giving you money based on the assessed value when, of course, all of us know that the price of a home in a black community is typically much lower than one in the white community. And so all these people were left short. A federal judge in 2010, 5 years after Katrina, declared Road Home a racially discriminatory policy. But by that point, of the $10 billion, there was like $150 million left, and it was too late. And so you go to black middle-class neighborhoods, and they're 60, 70% back 10 years after Katrina, and you compare it to Lakeview, a white prosperous community that was flooded after Katrina, it's 100% back. And the reason for that is policy. There was a policy put in place that harmed the black homeowners compared to the white homeowners, and so many black homeowners were left short because of this glitch, mistake, intentional. I'm not sure I could say why it happened, but it did happen, and it's just meant for an unequal recovery post-Katrina.
When I was reading your book, the images that again came to mind reminded me very much of the video, actually, of the death grip of Eric Garner by the police. Here you portray, and suddenly America saw on TV as though it had not existed and we were totally oblivious, the enormity of the poverty, the home split in half by rushing water, the trapped family struggling to flag down help from the rooftops, people who could not leave, they had no resources to do that, people searching for loved ones were swept away by the torrent. This was a case of abject, corrosive poverty on the soul of America. But the response still seems to be, and it unnerves me enormously as the years have passed, people like the darling of the liberal community, Malcolm Gladwell, now, who says in the New Yorker that there should have been a smaller footprint. It's a good thing. And he's talking, of course, about the thousands upon thousands who can't return, whether he realizes it or not. He's talking about the public housing that was needlessly destroyed, that was not damaged by the flood, which assured that poorer people, that people of African ancestry could not stay, would not be able to come back to these neighborhoods. That's so much of the picture and the lessons that I take from Katrina. Am I off base on that?
No, I mean, it's a couple of data points here. So at the time of Katrina, 1 in 4 New Orleanians did not own a car. And so on Sunday morning, right, 20 hours before Katrina hits, the mayor, Ray Nagin at the time, declares a mandatory evacuation. Well, you might as well have been saying you're required to take a week off in Aruba. I mean, a mandatory evacuation, but there was no buses, there were no trains, there was no plan to help the disabled, those without cars. And, and then there's people who had a car, but it was not exactly the most reliable car. And the average cost of evacuating, they estimated, was about $500. This was at the end of the month, August 29th. It was right before school started, or right at the start of school. New Orleans schools start early. And so, it caught people at a time when they didn't exactly have working people, middle-class people, did not have much discretionary income at that moment. So, this idea that you heard at the time, like, well, why didn't they get themselves out? They have the self to blame. It's like, well, how are they supposed to do that? I mean, some had an aunt or a friend, a neighbor who would take them out. But so many were trapped because they had no choice. Another point, the whole shrink the footprint debate was interesting. I was there for 8 months reporting on the storm and its aftermath in the New York Times, and that was my piece. I would go to all these meetings, and, I got it. You had geographers saying, like, hey, listen, this community is 5-8 feet below sea level, and it's vulnerable to this kind of flooding. The flip side of that is something I mentioned before, that, the problem is, who was living in the low-lying neighborhoods and why? So if you went with the plan that the city had put forward, this panel that the mayor had put together, you would have been telling 80% of the black population of New Orleans, I'm sorry, we're not going to rebuild your neighborhoods, but maybe you could find someplace else to live. I mean, it was just this impossible thing to do. But on the other hand, there was never any plan. And so what you see are all these half-built neighborhoods. The Seventh Ward, traditional black working-class neighborhood, bricklayers and clerks in City Hall, that kind of neighborhood. It's a wreck right now. I mean, it was this really stable neighborhood prior to Katrina. I mean, it had its issues, but it was a relatively stable neighborhood with home ownership. And now it's like 50-60% back, and you start to see newcomers to the city, largely white, moving in because, of course, they could get cheap housing there. It's not far from the center of town. Pontchartrain Park, a black middle-class neighborhood, historic neighborhood, a neighborhood that in the 1950s was the first subdivision in New Orleans. Excuse me, in the state of Louisiana, that allowed for black home ownership. It's a tragedy. It's maybe two-thirds back, three-quarters back, 10 years after Katrina. New Orleans East, a black professional class neighborhood with some very, very wealthy parts to it. There's a lot where the African American lawyers and judges and teachers, medical folks live. It's maybe 80% back 10 years after Katrina. And so we've been stressing kind of the impoverished aspect. I mean, that's what we all saw when we saw Katrina, in the aftermath of Katrina. But it's affected the black middle class and the black professional class. There are 100,000 less African Americans living in New Orleans today than at the time of Katrina. And this was a city of 455,000 at the time. We're talking about a profound change in a city. And yet, I just got back from New Orleans where they were having this celebration more than a commemoration of New Orleans, and you had the mayor, white mayor, you know, doing his victory lap of like, wow, look at the New Orleans miracle that, you know, we're back. In fact, he declared the recovery behind us, and, you know, let's move on. And like, how are they hearing that in these half-built communities?
Gary, the thing that I really thought was just stirring, I have to recommend, because for anyone who cares about poverty, for people who think black life matters, for people who are interested in the role of government in the wealth divide in this country, you really need to read Gary's book, After the Flood. It is an anatomy, or really a picking apart of so many of the hypocrisies and problems, perhaps their most eloquent recitation that exists today. So you really, really need to get that. Finally, in the time that we have left, and I'm really sorry, and I want you to come back just to look at some of the things that you've done so well, the evolution and distribution through the Road Home program, following people from the old line, money millionaires, to the middle class black families in New Orleans East, to the white transplants, to the Lower Ninth Ward natives. All of that is part of Gary's writing and books, and so important for people who care about social justice. How do you sum up? What have you learned? What do you want us to learn in the advent of Katrina on this, its 10th anniversary?
You know, I mean, the intentionality. You know, if a disaster happens, a city doesn't come back. I can understand that, you know, if the government had done what they could, but, you know, to cite Malcolm Gladwell's article, he has a long article in the New Yorker, you know, some people found a better life in Houston. You know, they went to better schools for the kids, maybe better health care, maybe they found a better job, whatever it was, and that's great. You found a better life, that's great. What I think is just so tragic about the post-Katrina New Orleans story is that there's so many people who were working hard to get back, and rather than government helping, they got in the way. Or even if government didn't do anything, they just got in the way. The policies they came up with were deliberately made to harm lower-income people to come back together. If you don't believe me, there were people saying it. You had white uptown elites, those who, you know, were running the business community, who used to run the city and were very unhappy that a 68% black city was being run by African-American leadership. They spoke openly about, this is our chance. This is our chance to change this city, to quote one, demographically, 68% black city, and politically, a black-run city. And by the way, within 5 years, with so many fewer African-Americans there, you had the city's first white mayor in 32 years, a white supermajority on the city council, a white prosecutor replaced a black prosecutor, you know, white police chief, whites were running the public housing and the school system. I mean, I quoted Tulane, a professor who called it the political defeat of Black New Orleans, and I have to think that was right. And again, it was deliberate. It was a deliberate attempt. It wasn't just like, well, okay, people found a better life, so that's all for the best.
Well, they were all betrayed by a political system that was supposed to be accountable to them as citizens, and the abandonment was only the beginning. Once the water receded, the dehumanization, the dehumanizing political events to follow would solidify the sentiment in many ways that no one cared. But we must make it so. Black Life Matters. Gary Rivlin, thank you so much for your extraordinary, important writing. There are so many lessons. I think we should send a free copy to all of the candidates for the presidency. They need a little education. And certainly all of us, let's get it. After the flood, Gary Rivlin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Mimi. Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it.
Another flood in another year. Louisiana, 1927, by Randy Newman.
What has happened down here? Is the wind half changed? Clouds roll in from the north, then it start to rain. Rained real hard, and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River have busted through, clear down to Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana. Trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.